Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, April 17, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behavior comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, sitting in for Mike McKean, and here with me are Views regulars and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On our program this week, the bombing at the Boston Marathon. We were glued to the TV, internet, and social media sites Monday afternoon as news of the explosions rocked the nation. Just moments before that, though, journalists across the country were tuned in for the announcement of the 2012 Pulitzer Prizes, celebrating the year's best journalism. Old stalwarts like the New York Times and Washington Post walked away with honors, but there were some surprises in the mix. We'll talk about some of those. In Philadelphia, the trial of abortion doctor Kermit Gosnell is making big headlines, but little has been reported on it elsewhere, begging the question, what does it take for a local story to go national? We'll try to answer it. And the BBC is taking heat from the London School of Economics after sneaking three undercover reporters on a student trip to North Korea to produce a documentary. Well, like so many others across the country, we're going to turn our attention now to Boston.
I found out from a guy running next to me that it had happened. He had his phone. He said there's a bomb at the finish line. And then a minute later, he said another one went off, another bomb, and that people were injured, and two were dead.
Harrowing stories like that from runners and spectators all over downtown Boston Monday. Turned out three people died and more than 175 were hurt when two bombs went off, just as the middle of the pack was coming across the finish line. The streets were lined with thousands of spectators, people off of work for the Massachusetts state holiday there cheering on the runners. The images and descriptions of the carnage were among the most brutally graphic we've seen on television and in the newspapers and online since 9/11. But Monday, we saw that the coverage took a decidedly different tack than we've seen in breaking news situations recently. The networks were a lot more, shall I say, guarded, taking care not to show any of the video coming in live. Everything had been pre-recorded, vetted, and played back. Lee, what was it about Monday's event that changed the media's behavior, made them slow down a little bit?
Well, I hate to say that we got a learning curve, because every time I say something like that, 2 hours later, we prove that we have no learning curve. But in a lot of the coverage that I have seen, there have been references to, for example, the Olympic Park bombing, where Richard Jewell, courtesy of the law enforcement folks who leaked his name to the media, was essentially hung, drawn, and quartered, only to later be proven innocent of all things. And so I think that what I saw journalists doing was two things that I thought were laudable. One, they were being very cautious about the use of the word terror and terrorism. Well, that's most. USA Today, of course, had to put it in a headline. But a lot of other papers, including the Kansas City Star, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the New York Times, did not. The second thing is journalists have been pretty cautious until about 2 hours ago when we're recording about sort of trying to get ahead of where authorities are in the case. And I think actually that caution is laudatory and worthwhile and does to some extent demonstrate that we are trying very hard to learn from our mistakes.
So, Charles, tell me, is this something that you think we're likely to see again? Is this a lesson learned from Newtown? Is this a lesson learned from Aurora? Or is this something that's going to go out the window with the next plane crash or the next shooting?
Well, apparently it went out the window with the first suspect or non-suspect, as the case may be. We came to praise them. In fact, the three of us were talking before we went on air about the fact that we gathered today with praise on our minds because the news media overall, now I'm going to throw out the Post. I'm going to throw out good chunks of CNN, which, of course, tweeted that they were going to treat it as an act of terror 2 days ago when they had not one scintilla of evidence that this was an act of terror. And I know you can make the abstract argument that any bombing that maims and kills people is an act of terror, but it's not. I mean, if we get into the finite meaning of the terminology, it's not. This could just as easily be a random deranged drifter as somebody with a political or ideological agenda. So beyond that, we came to praise them. And then what? A couple hours ago on Wednesday afternoon, there's a rumor, nothing else, a rumor, which every media outlet in the country apparently fell for between the hours of about 1 and 1:30, and then walked back as quickly as they humanly possibly could. None more than CNN, I don't think. I was flipping around, and I saw no one make a bigger fool of their collective selves than CNN. I mean, it was just painful to watch.
Well, and CNN has been, if you think about some of the big stories in the past year, CNN has been at the top of that list is those who are getting it wrong. Think back to the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare.
Well, I think CNN has gotten itself in an enviable place of thinking that first is always best. And so I think that they're in this place where the minute something crosses, they say, oh, well, we're going to go with it first and walk it back. That actually is a web ethic. The studies of web and bloggers say that you publish first and then correct later. And I think that there's a lot of that sort of infecting the traditional media. I was watching. Charles was flipping around. Yeah. I was sticking with one place, which happened to be NBC and its various properties, you know, all across the actual broadcast channel. They never fell for it. They said, right. Well, AP is reporting, but we can't confirm. And then they sort of tried to sort of dissect, if you will, what AP was reporting, found the language peculiar, and then started to walk it back and walk it back and walk it back, and finally wound up saying, we can't confirm any of this, and then going to, among other people, Secretary of State Kerry's testimony in Congress, which I gather they either had tweeted or they, you know, were listening in somehow, where he said there has been no arrest. We don't expect there to be an arrest. So, I mean, I think what we have in some sense is a good example here, a good example of a bad example, a good example of some self-corrective behavior that I really wish had not gone quite as far down the road as it did before somebody had to go, whoa, Nellie, we don't have enough fact here yet.
You know, the thing I find mystifying about this always is that the cognitive dissonance between being on Facebook, where I was in my office, cruising Facebook, watching television. I know it's a great job. And I was watching the feed on Facebook of all of my journalist friends saying, we get it right. Don't get it first. Get it right. I mean, there is absolute uniform belief among all the journalists that I know that it's not important to get it first. It's important to get it right. So why, if all of us believe that in the theoretical world, not even in the theoretical world, there are a bunch of working journalists on my feed too. Why don't we practice it? I mean, we preach it all the time, but then you watch it and we violate that rule over and over.
Well, how much of that is not wanting to get beat? I think back to what we used to talk about during my days as a web editor at the Chicago Tribune going back a few years. And we kind of operated under the assessment or the idea that the audience understood that in breaking news situations, that things were fluid and we were reporting the best of what we know. 3 or 4 years ago, I think the audience felt that way. Do you think that perhaps the audience is kind of giving up on that in some way and that it's beginning to damage credibility when this happens again and again?
Well, if you believe Pew and other places like that, not only have the audience given up, they've thrown us under the bus. We need to go back to more getting it right. And having beaten up pretty firmly on my journalistic colleagues, I do want to say that it is entirely possible that you have somebody in law enforcement who's essentially pulling a Richard Jewell is leaking to one particular reporter. In this case, it was, at least on what I was seeing, it was a reporter for AP, something that is A, untrue, but B, designed to help law enforcement. And we say it a lot, but it's hard to overemphasize how much we journalists are prisoners of our sources mm-hmm. when it comes to something like this, which is why you get all those rules about, well, you got to confirm it with two people who cannot possibly have told each other. In this day when we're worried about nanoseconds, that second confirmation comes hard and slow.
I also just don't understand what cosmic value is gained in a world that is instantaneous as this is. No one, absolutely no consumer of the news will ever remember that CNN or MSNBC or NBC or Fox got that little detail first. It has no journalistic value anymore. Well, that's a 1960s
especially when
concept.
It's happening midday on a Wednesday, because people are presumably not glued to their televisions or to their computers or to whatever.
Well, and if we paid attention professionally to the scholarship, which we tend not to do, what we should know is that when that little scintilla, but it's an important scintilla, comes over, most consumers will turn to another information source to see if they can confirm it there. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if we paid attention to what we know, we would not behave in this particular way.
Okay. Well, for every misstep, there is a lot of good journalism out there. And Monday afternoon, good journalism was lauded at Columbia University with the awarding of the Pulitzer Prizes. The New York Times walked away with 4, a showing bested only by its work in 2002. Among those honored, the investigative series iEconomy, a look at the American love affair with Apple products and its impact on the global economy.
This is David Barboza reporting from Chengdu in western China. The massive factory here belongs to the Foxconn Technology Group. It employs 120,000 workers and operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, making products like the Apple iPhone and iPad. The plant attracts young migrant workers who travel here mostly from poor rural parts of the country, eager to find well-paying high-tech jobs. But the reality is often something quite different.
Lee, there were 4 magnificent pieces that the New York Times had honored this week, but this one stuck out to you. How come?
Well, it stuck out to me in part because we've talked about this piece and a couple of the others that got Pulitzers on this show before. So that's, I guess, my way of chest thumping a little bit and saying good on us. But what was phenomenal about this reporting is the depth and the level of detail in what is essentially a closed society. And part of the reason that this reporting is so remarkable is it because it was this story, more than any others, that actually got Apple to change its behavior. So one of the things that the Pulitzers is supposed to reward is this whole notion of journalism as a public service. A public service is not just telling people stuff, although that is part of a public service, but if part of a public service can be getting an exceptionally large corporation to take a look at itself and to change what it does to the benefit not just of Americans, but to the Chinese, then that's journalism that really has an impact. And I think for those reasons, I mean, the depth of the reporting, the detail of the reporting, but also the subsequent impact of the story is one of the reasons that I think the Times deserved this particular prize.
I always think of the Pulitzers like Olympic diving. There's 2 scores, execution and difficulty, right? And this story had them both. It was beautifully executed. The multimedia around that story is just breathtaking. But beyond that, the degree of difficulty of this story, both in terms of getting human sources in a place where the average worker is scared to death to talk. And if you go read that story, I was rereading it the other day, the depth of quotation that he was able to elicit from people who you know were reluctant, first of all, even to open their mouths and say anything to him. But beyond that, he got such emotion, such depth out of those sources that you know he spent countless hours with these people. These are not 15-minute stenography interviews. These are long, depth interviews with each and every source in that story, of which there are dozens. So it's the kind of content that the Times can drop every now and again that, you know, the minute it hits the street, you go, oh, that's a contender.
Well, and, you know, nobody is surprised when you hear that the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Associated Press and the Wall Street Journal are walking away with Pulitzers. When you hear that the National Reporting Award went to 3 reporters from Inside Climate News, First thing everybody goes to do is Google Inside Climate News and find out what it is and what the work is that they did. Charles, introduce us to them a little bit.
Yeah, they're a very interesting shop. Actually, I met the guy who runs it years ago because he's been around climate issues forever. But he's also been around the Rockefeller Foundation, of which I was a grantee a long time ago. And he was a consultant to them on environmental issues. And I just happened to meet him at this retreat. Really nice guy. Had no idea that he had resurfaced with Inside Climate News until they won the Pulitzer. And I saw him on a web video somewhere. I went, hey, I know that guy. Anyway, that had nothing to do with anything, did it? But it's a fascinating little nonprofit. Online only web. They don't even have an office. They're scattered around laptops around the country. In fact, when they found out about the Pulitzer, they were in three different cities, I think. They are really, really good at one thing, and that is climate environmental stories. That's all they do all day, every day. And they were an outgrowth of a blog service that Rockefeller was funding that was just sort of an aggregation site. Like, here's news and links to the environment. And after a while, they went, you know, we really need to go tell some of these stories. Their claim to fame, the thing that won them the Pulitzer, was this Kalamazoo, Michigan pipeline break and spill, which looks eerily familiar to the one some of you have been reading some about. And we're going to talk a little bit about what makes a national story. Yeah. The fact that neither the Kalamazoo nor the Arkansas oil spills are a national story in the way that the Gulf spill was, to me, is a mystifying thing. But they are all over it.
So what do you guys think? Could this be a sign of change in how awards like the Pulitzers are given out? Is this kind of a birth for niche publications?
I don't know if it's a birth for niche publications, but I think you've got a couple of things going on here. One, I think there are some topic areas. I'm not going to call them issues. I'm going to say topic areas. Mm-hmm. Climate's one. Science is probably another. Medicine is probably a third, where to get serious expertise in the room means that you're going to be, to use Charles's metaphor about degrees of difficulty, you're already going to up the degree of difficulty of what you're going to be able to attempt and competently report. Climate is not something that scientists who study it, and certainly journalists who write about scientists who study it, is a quick study. It's something that you have to become steeped in, and that's a matter of years. So I think that's on the one hand. On the other hand, as a person who has analyzed for scholarly purposes coverage about climate and global climate change in the New York Times, The New York Times is not competition here. It hasn't been for the last 20 years. Their reporting is not particularly good. So if you want to go and find good reporting about this sort of thing, you are going to automatically sort of go to a niche publication. And I think you've got both of those two things sort of working together. You know, these folks are going to walk into a vacuum where even the bigger, more prestigious media outlets have had trouble.
Okay. Well, before we move on, I want to take a moment to brag a little bit and congratulate one of our own, Charles Minshew, a master's student in convergence journalism, one of my students, was actually listed as part of the staff in the winning breaking news prize this week given to the Denver Post for its work covering the Aurora movie theater shooting over last summer, last July. And, well, we're just really proud of Charles here and wanted to take a second to recognize him for that accomplishment. Last night on the BBC, over on the other side of the pond, a documentary aired on the program Panorama that has been creating a bit of a buzz. Charles, you brought this to our attention. Tell us a little bit about the history of what's gone on with the BBC and what they did over there.
Yeah, they three BBC reporters in an investigative unit. Panorama does sort of long-form investigative narrative documentaries. Really excellent work. I mean, everything I watch on Panorama is amazing. I haven't seen the North Korea documentary. I'm dying to see it.
I know, and I went to go try and watch it before we recorded this show today. And I can't find it. Well, no, it's actually online. We can find it. But because we aren't in England, the BBC won't let us watch it right away.
So, well, that sounds like a trip is in order.
Let's anyway, go.
The three of them essentially infiltrated through deceptive means a field trip, for lack of a better term. The London School of Economics was taking a study abroad sort of trip to North Korea, which I found absolutely fascinating. Who would know that you could take a study abroad trip to North Korea? They, I'm not even sure under what guise they made themselves part of the group. Maybe they just signed up and off they went. But they definitely did not tell the students or the parents of the students or the administrators that they were news gathering. Mm-hmm. I think they made it apparent to a couple of the administrators that they wanted to go along. And I would think if you had like one synapse firing in your brain and three people from the BBC said, we want to accompany you to North Korea, you might think that they're going to film. But regardless of that, they went under what I think are pretty deceptive means. I'm not sure they endangered any of the kids, but they could have pretty easily, I think, endangered some of the kids. And it has become, to use the British term, a kerfuffle of the highest order across the pond. It is dominating media news over there right now.
Everybody's looking at me, so I'm going, okay. In some ways, this is kind of a no-brainer. At least as I was reading, Amy, what you'd posted on the blog, they said they were going to do a film, but not what kind of film. And I don't know that necessarily people would have thought, oh, well, it's journalists infiltrating, because actually we're not supposed to do that sort of stuff. And the Beeb doesn't have a particularly long history of doing that kind of thing. Smacks a little bit of phone hacking. And I thought we were trying to discourage that behavior on the other side of the pond. But people certainly know, because it's happened a lot, that when you get to North Korea and you start taking pictures, that you come under suspicion. And this is a very authoritarian place that's not particularly friendly to outsiders. And within that has been decidedly unfriendly to journalists. I mean, I do remember it's not been that long that Al Gore essentially made a road trip along with a couple of other people to free a couple of folks who had either deliberately or not so deliberately gotten on the wrong side of the border between North and South Korea. So, I mean, no, they didn't tell anybody, but I'm going to disagree with Charles only a little bit and say, I think they put themselves and everybody they were with in danger. And it is going to have to be one heck of a documentary to come anywhere near justifying that to me. And I'm not sure that it can.
Well, and it's interesting. There was a link I had put up on the blog that you can take a look at, a review of the program. And one of the things that the reviewer was saying in The Guardian is that there really wasn't a whole lot of new information that came out of this. The journalists who went didn't uncover anything or share anything or tell the audience anything that hadn't already been reported about what's going on in North Korea.
There was a documentary at True False a few years ago called Burma VJ, in which in another authoritarian regime, the answer was to take cameras in, sneak cameras in, to citizens of Burma who then reported on the ground and shipped the footage out. It was sort of an import-export business for journalism. That would seem to me to be a much more responsible and perhaps more effective way to document life on the ground in North Korea that would not endanger, I mean, otherwise completely unwitting students from the London School of Economics who have no journalistic interest whatsoever at all. That's probably the most troubling part to me, is the use of, you're really using third parties there.
Well, let's bring it back home a little bit closer. In Philadelphia, the trial is continuing in the case of Kermit Gosnell. He's accused of performing late-term abortions that resulted in live births and then severing the baby's spinal cords. In Pennsylvania, the case is making big headlines. Everywhere else, it's barely a blip. What makes this case different than that of, say, Trayvon Martin or the Steubenville rape case, that the networks and national papers are shying away from covering it?
One of the things that makes it different is it not occurring on either the East or the West Coast. The Boston Marathon was in Boston. Part of the reason it got the coverage it has received and is more likely to receive is because it's on that East Coast media axis where you've got all of the big players, with the exceptions of the ones on the very West Coast, that are there, they're proximate, they've got sources, they've got people on the ground. It's easier. Steubenville, Ohio, not so much. I'm not sure that Steubenville would have gotten the coverage if it did. Had it not been for social media and the kinds of things that wound up in social media. In this particular case, the details are pretty icky. That's a technical term for you wouldn't want to read them over breakfast. I don't think that...
Is that reason, though, not to cover it?
It's not... It's reason not to cover it, but it's certainly reason that a lot of people will shy away from it. I also think that it's not being covered because, as I understand the case, so I'm going to walk out a little bit on a limb here, the people who have been taken advantage in this particular case are poor people and people of color. We don't tend to do a good job covering those communities, regardless of what happens to them, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. And last but certainly not least, this is abortion. It brings up a raft of difficult issues for journalists about covering something like this. And unfortunately, it's hard, no matter what your feelings are on the abortion debate, when you, you know, read the details of this and you go, gee, rusty instruments and a whole lot of other things going on here. It's hard to find the pro lobby for that this particular person was somehow doing the right thing.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, if this were a beautiful white abortion provider, or if there were victims, identifiable adult victims who in some way were exotic, attractive, rich, urban, white, all of that would probably have a great deal to do with coverage. I mean, I wish that were not the case, but it just is. And it probably has something to do with not being on the D.C. New York axis. But probably not, because if you activated those other variables, as you did in Steubenville, they'll get in the car and drive, provided you have other things that attract them to it. There's nothing about that case from its facts that sounds very attractive in terms of pulling in particularly broadcast media, I think. And well, I mean, print, too, to a large extent. There's just no compelling video, I think, is the term that's thrown around a lot.
And the other thing, Amy, about the environmental stories that you mentioned, because the Kalamazoo story was the front page story on the Detroit Free Press this weekend, because it is taking such an incredibly long time to clean up, and clean up is the wrong verb. It's nowhere near cleaned up. It's not likely to be cleaned up anytime soon. But I think this is a place where people tend to think there's this localized environmental story, and we don't do a very good job of connecting these localized environmental dots to something larger that's going on. In this particular case, that's unfortunate, to say the least, because, of course, we're having that fight over a pipeline that's going to carry this same kind of oil throughout the United States. So this, again, I think is a lack of legwork, if you will.
What's amazing to me in this one is you have the Kalamazoo oil spill and you have the Arkansas oil spill. And meanwhile, at the national level, you have the Keystone debate, which the Keystone debate has been a very national story. In both of those oil spills, one up, one down, you have the same sort of oil, this dilbit, which is not oil. When you think about oil, you think about the Gulf oil spill. Right. Oil being this thing that rises to the surface of water and then is skimmed off. Oh, no, no, no. The stuff they want to put in Keystone is the consistency of peanut butter. And it sticks to everything. And I went and did some reading today on the Arkansas spill. There's some online videos you can go see that are just absolutely shocking. I mean, neighborhoods that are inundated with this stuff and will be ruined forever. I mean, they'll have to bulldoze those neighborhoods. Why we have the national story at the pipeline level, but not at the spill level, is just... it's one of those great mysteries of media.
Well, and the interesting thing is that the Free Press made all those connections.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry to say that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for listening and watching. There's more background for today's topics on our links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. Hope you'll go ahead and check those out. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there. Send us email via our regular email address, views@kbia.org. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan, who directs our show, KBIA's Pat Akers, who's handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to tune in next week. Mike McKean will be back with you all for another edition of Views of the News.